The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk
on 92.7 and 106 FM.
Welcome to The Money Show on this Tuesday evening. I am Bruce Whitfield. The Money Show brought to you by APSA. Some stories are just getting started. Your story matters. APSA is a registered FSP. Welcome to The Money Show, and wonderful to be in your company this evening. We are going to be chatting to Wayne McCurry about a terrible day on markets today. We'll explain why it all happened like that in a world that should be feeling a lot better than it is. Explain that as well. JC took a big beating. We'll look at that with Wayne. And also later on with Warren Ingram. The idea of saving for the future is, of course, a very captivating and a very important thing. Lots of you, however, tell me that you can't save because you don't have enough money for the present. So how do you prepare for the future when there isn't enough money in the now? Very important discussion. Rona Kapoldis will join us for the Africa Business Report. Our signals feature this evening, just about the outlook for the global economy and the signals that we're seeing. The inimitable Dr. Iraj Abedian will join us on that particular front. But yeah, the rocking US economy really should be good news for all of us around the world. The irony is that it's outperforming everyone to such an extent that its strength is actually hurting. The IMF today saying the US is on track to grow at double the rate of any other G7 country this year. Could grow 2.7%. Consumer spending strong, job creation is stable. And despite some very high-profile job cuts at companies like Tesla, things are actually going rather well. The dollar is super strong, and that makes life very difficult for our importers and, of course, our own Reserve Bank's ability to cut interest rates. And that, in turn, makes life difficult for you. And none of it's made easier, of course, by Vladimir Putin's continued assault on Ukraine, Israel, on Gaza, the extra fireworks over the weekend to make everybody very, very worried. Look at currencies. The Indonesian rupiah. I'm not sure how many rupiah you've held in your hand before, but the Indonesian currency is at its lowest point in 4 years. The Indian rupee at a record low. Against the dollar. The Malaysian ringgit at its worst levels in a quarter of a century. Our rand, not quite at record lows, but it's not far away. The dollar is absolutely dominant and massively strong. And that, of course, wreaks havoc in all kinds of spaces too. So lots to discuss tonight on The Money Show. I do hope you will stay engaged and in tune and keep with us tonight. If you want to give us a shout, give us a call. We would love to hear from you. You can drop us a voice note too, of course, on the numbers that you know so well.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Well, the world's two biggest economies are growing strongly. So why does it feel so bad for the rest of us? US growth this year likely to outstrip that of its G7 partners twice. And China is growing faster than expected at 5.3%. For South Africa, however, the outlook is grim. The IMF saying our medium-term prospects are the weakest they have been in decades. Isa Mthlanga is the chief economist at RMB and joins us this evening from Joburg. Why does the world feel as weak as it does in the face of such strong growth in the world's two biggest economies, Isa?
Thanks, Bruce. I think it's not necessarily the world. I'm sure if you were to ask U.S. workers, if you're looking at non-farm payrolls that were released a couple of weeks ago, surpassing expectations by nearly 50%. That should tell you that U.S. people are feeling different to how we are feeling. But also, if you were to ask people that are in the euro area, for instance, they would perhaps be in a similar situation to where we are, given that European economic growth is lower. And also, the costs continue to rise. And then if you ask people that are in the Middle East, they will say completely different. They are in a far more worse environment than where we are, given the conflict that is currently happening between Hamas, Israel, and now including other countries such as Iran and Jordan and others. So the situation is different. It depends on where we are. And if you have to look at SA, our growth within the emerging market world, at least the ones that are shown in the IMF World Economic Outlook, is the slowest expectation for this year. Then the second slowest is at 2%. We are at 0.9. Even when you look for next year, again, we are the slowest, just at about 1.2%. So we are one of only four major emerging market economies whose growth has been downgraded this year. And again, next year, we are one of only four, again, whose growth has been downgraded slightly. And that speaks to our own domestic challenges that we are very well aware of. Load shedding, its logistics, its crime and corruption that inhibits things such as, tourism, for instance. All of those things are weighing on our economic growth, which means the solution has to be domestic.
No, exactly right. And I was just reflecting yesterday, I spoke to the author of a book called Exponential Emirates, and reflecting on the 50 years of astonishing growth that the Emirates have seen, and the fact they've got another 50-year plan to take them through to 2067 or whatever it was, the year that they're looking forward to. And I'd recently been traveling around Spain and looking at the huge economic development in Spain, and Spain and South Africa's past not that different from a fascist control point of view and isolation point of view. And just countries make different choices at different really pivotal times in their economic cycles or in the economic lifetimes, I suppose. They're those that make good strategic long-term decisions and put smart people in charge of big projects and plan those projects to coincide with other big projects. And somehow those societies tend to get really good economic outcomes. There are a couple of us who simply don't. And we don't because we don't plan. And if we do plan, we don't implement. And that's the long-running crisis of confidence that we're going through at the moment.
Absolutely. And I would say our body politic behaves like an overweight person that never goes to gym, never eats well until they are told by the doctor that they will suffer a heart attack. And then we start, responding vigorously in all ways. You can go back as far as 1994, just on the brink of the Civil War, and then you go into just before 2000, we were told we have load shedding. 2007, we never did anything until load shedding hits. And now you can see the same thing with infrastructure in general, because it is in a state of decay and inhibiting growth and having political consequences. We are now responding with all these structural reforms. I would guess the positive out of these things, we have never gotten into an actual heart attack. We have responded quickly enough once we were told things are so critical. We hope potentially going forward, we don't have to wait until the doctor says something is critically wrong. But what we are seeing currently is quite encouraging. We might feel as if things are so negative, we can debate in terms of the speed of implementation, but I think in terms of the direction, it's clearly in the positive direction. We just need to see that speed improving.
Of that there is no doubt. However, we look at the medium-term outlook. The IMF says it's never been as dark as it is. And I think it is ignoring the progress that has been made at Vulindlela. We were talking to the CEO of a company called Traction, which operates 85 trains in 7 countries north of our borders, and saying that we're on the cusp of getting to a point where he will be able to order the locomotives in order to compete using Transnet tracks and things. And it was massively exciting. And then he went, well, it is a 2 or 3 year process, because you can't just buy trains off the shelf and you can't just get them in the country and you can't just do this. So again, all of these things, unfortunately, if you operate the way we do in a knee-jerk and reactive fashion rather than a planned strategic fashion, means that you really do boom and bust in an economy like ours, because these reforms, as good as they are and as welcome as they are reluctant and long-delayed reforms.
Indeed. Look, if you have to look at the growth forecast currently, almost everybody is not taking into account the future outlook of reforms. We take policy as is today and say, what would be the implication for economic growth? We have been disappointed historically to price in expected reforms which never come. So implementation has been a big challenge. So learning from that, we simply just say, given what we know today and what is currently implemented, what does it mean for economic growth? Better to be surprised on the upside relative to be surprised on the downside in future.
So the Reserve Bank says we'll grow at 1.2% this year. The IMF says we'll grow at 0.9%. Who's right? Well, who's less wrong, put it that way?
Bruce, the economy is a complex system with so many economic growth players such that to measure accurately at a 10 basis point accuracy is almost nonsensical. So there isn't any difference between a 1.1 and a 0.9. It could be measurement errors, and you would know very well that, you know, economic statistics, particularly GDP, gets revised so often as new data comes into play, as measurement methodologies improve. So, you know, we shouldn't read too much into the point decimal digit differences that the IMF has relative to the Reserve Bank.
What's your outlook? I mean, are you willing to go to say that, you know, 2025, all things being equal, based on what we know of the reforms that are being implemented and are in place, and as we start getting interest rate cuts, perhaps this year, perhaps next year, that we start seeing the 2 and 3% growth rates? Or are we so structurally deficient that we don't get to that in the short term?
Look, in the short term, it's going to be difficult to get to, those numbers, in the order of 3%. We have 1.3% for 2024, 1.6% for 2025. We are penciling in an improvement from an energy perspective that we think is likely going to surprise on the upside. Even when you look at last year's growth of 0.6%, at some point we're expecting a full year contraction because of the intensity of load shedding. But because of the addition that we saw from the private sector, we were surprised on the upside. So we are trying to anticipate that and pencil it into our expectation. But over the medium to longer term, we can then speak about, north of 2 to 2.5% economic growth once we see the reforms that we are talking about in logistics, in energy, continue to be implemented, which we think is likely, to be implemented or not.
Azam Tlanga, thank you. He is the chief economist at RMB tonight. The IMF warning that while the rest of the world is growing, there are a couple of countries that aren't, and we're one of them. And our outlook is the worst that it's been in decades. And when you hear that sort of quite negative outlook, I wonder how happy you are about the taxes you pay. I ask this question with a purpose, because I'm sure we'd all be a lot happier if we were satisfied that the money we did pay over was being put to good use, not just to help those that survive on state benefits, although that is important, and not just to pay very big public service wage bills, because some of those are very important, but also to invest in meaningful projects that drive longer-term growth. And this is where we're failing, because we're spending so much on the first two that there's very little left on the growth projects. If we fail, I suppose, at any one of these levels, ultimately the country will implode. Many are discovering this as a reality. And if you are going to be paying a big tax bill, I think you should be celebrating. Do you celebrate paying a big tax bill? You've either got a decent income, you're either making a profit in your business, or you've sold something for much more than you paid for it, so you're paying capital gains tax. You should be thrilled. The entrepreneur and the dragon, Mark Cuban, who's got that Peter Pan face. He hasn't aged in 20 years. But Mark Cuban has just done an EFT to America's Internal Revenue Service. For how much? $275,900,000. And he's delighted. He's over the moon. He's celebrating the fact that he's paying so much tax. He posted on X. He said, got the final number and the wire is complete. Do I expect all of it to be used wisely? Of course not. So why is he happy? Well, he's making money. He's making tons of money. This year, he's made a lot more than he normally does, thanks to the sale of a 58% stake in the Dallas Mavericks NBA team. And that's been a long-term investment that he made in the year 2000. That's when he cashed out in the dot-com boom, and he made his first $1 billion following the sale of Broadcast.com to Yahoo. He's worked very hard with the Dallas Mavericks and has got them to a stage where that he has been able to sell it for an absolute fortune. And capitalism increasingly, of course, is unpopular. Capitalism is unpopular, especially in social media worlds, mostly because, yes, there are indefensible excesses in some parts of capitalism. But if you look at the amount of tax that people like Mark Cuban are paying, you've got to say, hold on a second. You've got to encourage those with a risk appetite, the energy, the big ideas to be investing in growth. You do. And there are only two ways for governments to generate income. That's to borrow it or to tax it. And taxing it is far more preferable than borrowing it, frankly, provided that tax, of course, is in a measured and equitable fashion. The likes of Mark Cuban, we should be celebrating him, paying his $275,900,000. But yeah, it's tough. We've got a really polarized world. And Mariana Mazzucato, and if you've got a kid in the car, I'm going to be quoting her directly, and she uses a slightly rude word. So this is your warning for a slightly elevated adult content. It's not that bad, but it's slightly elevated. And Mariana Mazzucato at Davos, a couple of Davoses ago, said Labour's share of global income is at its lowest level ever, and that pisses people off. That was her quote. Not me, it was her. Because the super rich are getting so filthy super rich and workers are not getting the same sort of spoils, they get agitated about it. The comparison of it upsets them. So yes, we get these vast sums of money that some people generate. It makes them filthy rich and it makes them a bit obnoxious sometimes. But the value they generate, the taxes they pay, make the work of government possible. And it should reduce government's increasing reliance on debt. And if we get to rely on debt, we simply are taxing our children. So yeah, we should be happy to pay tax, particularly if we're paying lots of tax, because it means you've made lots of money. Mark Cuban is a good example of that.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
To Wayne McCurry we go. Wayne, of course, as you know by now, is from Wealth and Investments at First National Bank. Not that anybody is paying much capital gains tax today based on the performance of stock markets. It really is very, very volatile and very, very torrid at this moment in time, Wayne McCurry.
Yeah, it's difficult. I mean, last Friday it was exactly the opposite. The mining shares were up 5%. The platinum shares, I mean, Impala was up 10%. And yet two trading days later, everything's falling in a heap again. And unfortunately, we're going to go through this volatility, ride this seesaw until there is a definitive data point that says interest rates are going to fall or they're not going to fall. And we haven't had that data point yet. You know, one day there's good for inflation data comes out, market goes up, rand strengthens, the next day it's bad. And this is typically what does happen during these transition phases where you're going from a period of rising interest rates to a period of falling interest rates. I mean, the actual data that came out today was the estimate that the U.S. was going to grow at 2.5%, which is double what the other G7 countries are growing at. Now, that sounds like good news, especially in the U.S., but it's actually bad news for the interest rate outlook. And then China came up with extremely good GDP numbers, which on the face of it, you would think would boost our mining shares, but clearly not.
Yeah.
And of course, this escalation in the U.S., in the Middle East doesn't help at all.
No, it doesn't. I mean, there are lots of factors for lots of sellers of shares, of course, sort of investments on markets around the world. We saw it play out in Europe today. We've seen it play out in many parts of the world, particularly on the JSE, where we closed below 73,000. But U.S. markets feel a little bit more confident this evening. There's that sense of, yes, we've got an inflation issue brewing potentially, but my goodness me. Look at the growth. Look at the jobs. Look at those salaries that are being paid. And, you know, on the ground, people are feeling very, very confident.
Yeah, they're feeling confident. They're extremely, I suppose, fortunate. I don't know if that's the correct word, that they didn't build up excess debt in the whole system. They got such a fright in the global financial crisis 13 years ago that companies and individuals didn't take on huge debt, so they've been able to ride out this period of higher interest rates far, far better than what you would have thought under normal circumstances. You know, normally these interest rates would have burst some debt bubble and the economy would have actually got into recession, let alone growing so strongly. So every previous occasion when interest rates have gone up to this extent, and you could argue that this time around the interest rates have gone up as a percentage much higher than in previous times, every single previous time the economy's gone into a recession. Yet this time it's reporting extremely strong growth. but we'll still see the inflation numbers that come out. And of course, don't forget, there's been huge stimulus pushed into the U.S. economy over the last 2 or 3 years. I mean, the amounts are in the trillions of dollars. But interest rates are still coming down, that's my view. And South Africa will do significantly better, our shares, our rand, our economy, over the next 2 or 3 years, as hopefully the lower interest rates brings a commodity upcycle. But it's, of course, very difficult to beat this drum when you get days like today. But as I said, it's very normal for this to happen during a transitional period where you're moving from high interest rate environment or a rising interest rate environment to a falling interest rate environment. There's always uncertainty in these big change or cycle changes.
Yeah, it's really tough. I mean, you just look at the big share price moves today. Predominantly, the damage is done by our commodity shares, and that's to be expected because of the volatility in the underlying commodities. The currency, remarkably stable, I thought, considering the amount of sort of fear and trepidation in other parts of the market. Maybe it's got to wake up and catch up, but certainly the currency market weak, but not collapsing.
No, it's not at 1950. So, yeah, it is weak, and a lot of this is dollar strengthening. Our crosses against the pound and that, actually not bad at all over the last couple of days. But, of course, we'll have to see. I mean, fair value for the rand is still below 17. I know it sounds outrageous, but I think we'll get there over the next 2 to 3 years, as long as we get a commodity upcycle. Now, I can remember every single time period, 2015, 2008, 2002, 1994, I can go back during these periods of quite a severe drop-off in the commodity cycle, and you're at this turning point, there wasn't one single reason anyone could find as to why commodity prices would recover, and yet they did every single time. This is a cycle.
Wayne McCurry, always good to calm our nerves, from Wealth and Investments at First National Bank. Thank you, Wayne McCurry, very much indeed. Let's go to Eyewitness News now with Maki Malapo. It's Eyewitness News brought to you by Khaliqs. Khaliqs for the businessman who knows what he wants. 6:30.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
The Money Show brought to you by APSA. Some stories are just getting started. Your story matters. APSA is a registered FSP. Now, I think it's important that we get to know each other a bit better. As I mentioned yesterday, my colleagues at Prime Media made a very nice video of me being a little bit, you know, foolish and silly, and you know, they were asking lifestyle-y questions and films and books and food and you know, that sort of stuff, and it's lovely, it's charming. But there are a couple of things you don't know about me. One, I was once shortlisted to become a NASA astronaut, and I looked at the training program. It was quite rigorous, and apartheid had just ended, and I felt that it would be a massively challenging thing. I didn't think I'd get through it, but it was exciting. But I gave it up to do charity work in Rwanda just after the genocide, and I found that very fulfilling. And I don't talk about it, generally, because it's not true. How do you know? This is the best segue I think I've ever done. I really do. Stephen Logan is the chief executive of the verified CV company Privy Seal. And I thought I was quite a compelling storyteller there at that point. I even believed I was a NASA astronaut or, you know, going to Rwanda after the genocide. I wish I'd done such meaningful things with my life, Stephen. But people do lie like cheap carpets on their CVs. And you've come up with a system to catch them out. And I think that's a very valuable and positive thing. What have you done to verify the veracity of CVs?
Well, thanks for having me on, Bruce. I think that what we've realized is that somebody needed to do something a bit innovative and keep it simple. And so what we've done is we've built a platform that allows you to validate key information simply as the owner of that information at no cost on our platform by issuing what we call digital credentials. So you can do that for your employees, you can do that for your members. Whoever it is that you want to validate some key piece of information for, you can do that on Privy Seal. And that information is then collected together and it goes into that person's verified CV. And there's the joy of it for us is that it really can apply to anything. So work experience, qualifications, skills, licenses, memberships, accreditation. We've got lots of clients who use our paid-for product, but we have made our platform available for this purpose at no cost because it's a massive problem and we really want to address it.
So how then, you can verify official documents. So if I've got a PhD from the London School of Economics and I submit my certificate to you, you see that it is real, true and original and not a factor of my own imagination or a fake copy. And you verify it and you put that into a database and says, Bruce has got this London School of Economics certificate. However, it's harder to prove whether I did or did not go and we'll do some charity work during the Rwanda genocide. That, you know, that may require a different kind of verification.
Yeah, so what we have found working over the years is that our clients have gone and made their databases of qualifications available to us, and then we go and we create the digital credentials. So we have to have the client, the actual issuer, go and create the credential on our platform. But that is then displayed on their domain name. And that's how we validate that it actually comes from a good source, because it comes from, for example, in your case, let's say you're working for UNICEF or UNESCO, or one of these gigantic organizations. They would be creating those credentials on our platform, and they would say, Bruce worked in Rwanda from this date to this date in this role. And consequently, because there's no cost and because it appears on their domain, we feel that is now highly, the authority of the credential has been proved, and it can go into your verified CV, and you can rely on that because it's actually coming off the, you know, whatever appropriate domain for that particular organization. So I can't name all our clients, but you know some of them are very, very big. And we've obviously got several qualification authorities making use of the platform, as well as regulators and professional bodies and the like. But this is for any company to use. So if you've got employees, you can just create these credentials to recognize their experience.
So if, I mean, in the olden days, a CV was rubbish in, rubbish out, truth in, truth out. You could fudge it. And a lot of people still do, and we know this, and that's the problem that you're seeking to address. When it comes to it, is your service to provide surety on an applicant's CV, or can a company refer CVs to you for checking? Is it one a case of me saying, please, will you verify my CV and give me the QR codes I need? Or can companies actually come and double-check the credentials that people claim to have with you?
Look, there are lots of background checking companies, and they can continue to do their work. They charge a fee to go and check a CV, and that's, you know, sometimes difficult for them. I mean, there have been some notable failures in that regard, very high-profile failures. But what we're doing is we're saying go to verified-cv.com, go and register, and go and create credentials as a company that issues any kind of validation. And we will go and gather those credentials together to prove that a person has actually got the experience and qualifications that have been verified on our platform. All of those credentials will be on the domain name of the issuer, and that will give you comfort that actually they are genuine. So we don't go and do background checking. That is a service that other companies perform. What we're trying to do is create a means for South Africans, and not only South Africans, but anyone, to go and create credentials legitimately on their domain, whatever the company's website domain is, and then for those to be gathered together in a verified CV. So nobody has to go and do that background checking, because we think background checking is laborious, costly, and actually impedes job creation.
I would agree. Ultimately, there's no substitute for personal integrity, but I think we've passed that point. I'm guessing there's a future, Stephen, where it's going to be, and I'm sure you hope, essential that you have verified content on your CV, especially in a digital world where that becomes possible. In the olden days where you went to a print shop and you printed off a couple of pages of a Word document that was badly laid out and had some spelling mistakes in it, nowadays digital technology makes verification almost an imperative. And I would suggest that if you were one of only 10 out of 100 candidates who actually bothered to get your credentials verified, you'd also automatically go up the list quite quickly in terms of, you know, hiring potential.
Absolutely. So, you know, the reality is that people are looking at, HR managers are looking at thousands of CVs. And AI has the potential to go and really help them order those in terms of who is the most likely fit. But if you go and you're able to go and just through a platform like this, verify-cv.com, if you're able to go and request credentials, get the people that you know you worked for to validate your experience, etc., then the reality is that that CV that you're going to present is very easy to share, first of all, and as every single company that you worked for will be listed there, on and the credential will be on their domain name. So, you know, let's say it's dairyfarm.co.za, you worked there as a manager looking after the ice cream manufacturing. That is something that can appear on dairyfarm.co.za, and that gives authority to that credential. And what we are hoping is that thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of companies will do that because there's no cost. And suddenly all of their employees will have a means of verifying their experience. It will go into a verified CV. The HR people that are getting those CVs will say, oh, great, I don't have to go and check this. I don't have to employ background checkers. That's saved me a couple of thousand rand. Fantastic. And this CV will rise up to like cream to the top of the pile. So that's the idea behind it.
Lovely. Stephen Logan, thank you. He is the chief executive at PrivySeal, the verified CV company. Interesting business. And again, solving a problem. The problem is that too many people are dishonest. The problem is that too many people lie on their CVs. And as a result, you're going to need to prove your innocence so that you can, like he says, be part of the cream that rises to the top of the milk of applications that, you know, go into a very scarce jobs environment.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by APSA. Your story should be heard. Your story matters. APSA is a registered FSP.
I mentioned earlier all of the global currencies that are getting plastered, and some at 25-year lows versus the US dollar. The Malaysian currency is getting beaten. Indonesia's getting hit. India's getting hit. We've been hit. We're not at record lows, but we're very close to record lows. Huge volatility, not only in investment markets, but also in currency markets. And that undermines confidence. It undermines the ability to do long-term planning, particularly if you want to invest, particularly if you want to bring money in, take money out. As a, you know, and for companies, this is a very, very tricky thing to do. For you, it may be whether, you know, how you time your Forex purchase for your, you know, your holidays in the winter months, for example. Let's talk to Andre Cilia, Director and Currency Strategist at Treasury One. And yeah, we've gone through these enormous whipsaws of volatility, and we're back in the maelstrom of that volatility right now, Andre, with the view that America is just not yet in the mood to cut interest rates.
Yes, good evening, Bruce, and good evening to all the listeners. If one looks at their figures coming out, the retail sales figure increased by 0.7% in March, but the core retail sales jump for February was revised to 1.1%, which was an upward revision. So that leads to people reworking their numbers in terms of their growth rate for the first quarter, which seems to be have ended really well. And now expecting growth in the U.S. to run around the 3% level for the first quarter. Now, that points clearly to very robust growth still, an economy and consumers doing really well. And that puts the Federal Reserve at ease in saying, we don't really need to cut rates because the economy is doing well. They can continue buying back all their bonds, draining money and liquidity out of the market as per plan, and wait for inflation to actually subside, which does not seem to be the case at the moment. And that, of course, gets helped.
Yeah.
And that gets helped by geopolitical tensions. That's on the increase. And the possibility of an oil price that might surge to higher levels, which will place further problems into the U.S. in terms of inflation that might be not turning downwards, but upwards.
And that raises the risk of a rise in interest rates, which 6 months ago seemed impossible because we were meant to be into the rate-cutting cycle by now. Here we sit at the bottom tip of Africa. We are very used to a hugely volatile exchange rate. We're used to a weakening exchange rate and a steadily weakening exchange rate. We're going into our own election cycle. And I'm not too sure that despite all of the noise and clutter, that we have in our political discourse and in the public discourse in South Africa, that much of that is having that much of an impact, really, on currency valuations at the present. It is all about these very distant and unfortunately quite boring global issues.
It is unfortunately, and one can call it a boring issue, but that is the key driver to markets. You know, the economies in the world are very, very interlinked. It's a global environment. And the biggest economy in the world is the United States of America. And unfortunately, they are pretty much in charge of dictating the path for other countries. Locally, I don't think that the elections is currently having a major impact on anything. I think that could change as we get closer to the elections, and I think even after the elections we will have a more dramatic impact when we start talking about coalitions and how they are formed and with whom they are formed. But for the moment, that's on the back foot. The global center is center stage at this point in time.
No, exactly. And for anybody who is planning either bringing money in or taking money out, how do they best plot timings on these things, if that is at all possible in the current environment? I mean, we accept that at some point American interest rates do start to drop. At some point things start to settle down and people get used to whatever the status quo will be in South Africa. And then you kind of normalize a little bit from what I hope is a fairly short-term blowout at the moment. What's your reading?
Okay, so when one speaks about taking money out of the country, then it's for the diversification of your investment portfolio. And I don't think that the value of the currency at the point that you take it out becomes the most important thing. The emphasis should be on the diversification and having your eggs spread over more than one basket. And then it's about the growth that gets returned. And when one diversify and look at investments in other areas, then I don't think one should be looking at a currency play, but how do you diversify, firstly, in which asset classes you diversify into, and then you should look and measure the growth over a longer period rather than just a currency play that is a very short-term gain or loss. So I don't think that the currency value should play a major role in the diversification of your portfolio.
That's a very important answer, Andre Celia. Thank you very much indeed. Director and currency strategist at Treasury One. We do get hit up in the short term. We do get, 20 to the dollar, whatever the case might be. It creates panic rather than cool, calm, logical thinking. And I think that's very important. Thank you very much to Andre this evening here on The Money Show. Bring us very neatly to Eyewitness News at 7 o'clock, after which I will be chatting not only to Rona Kapoldis and to Warren Ingram, but I'll also be talking to you about the Superdry story, why Superdry is finding itself in trouble, and also pick up with Dr. Raj Abedian about the inflation picture. It's been a big theme on today's show.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by APSA. Your story should be heard. Your story matters. APSA is a registered FSP. The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
On 92.7 and 106 FM.
Outraged I am. Outraged. I was going to tell that stock exchange story from Denmark myself, but Denmark, he stole it from me. But yeah, fascinating tale and a tragic tale. And these old buildings, I mean, you just got to go into many of these old buildings, of course, and you just see the quality of the wiring and the wood and everything else and the vulnerability and how dry they are and how old they are. And it doesn't take much. And woof, history goes up in smoke. I'll tell you more about super dry in a bit, if Mikey doesn't steal that one from me, coming up in just a little bit. But first, Dr. Raja Bedian is going to join us, just talk about the state of the world and as we see it at the moment, followed by Ronak Gopaldas at Signal Risk, and then we'll be joined at 7:30, as always, on a Tuesday, by Warren Ingram, talking personal finance. And tonight, how to invest when you don't feel like you have anything to invest. All of that on The Money Show this evening.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
Well, time for our signals feature this evening. And markets have been reading signals on global inflation, the future of monetary policy, all wrong. 9 months ago, they went mad in anticipation of the huge number of rate cuts that we're yet to, we're going to see and have yet to materialize. And our signals feature this evening is recalibrating a little bit with the help of the chief executive at Pan African Investments and Research Services, Dr. Iraj Abedian. Why has everybody got this cycle, Iraj? I say everybody, most people, got the cycle so wrong.
Good evening, Bruce, to you and to the listeners. I think we got it wrong for two reasons. One is unpredictable and somehow chaotic political, geopolitical risk in the globe. Nobody could have predicted the timing of what has transpired in the Middle East over the past 6 months, and more specifically over the past week with the Iranian attack on Israel, following an Israeli attack on the Iranian consulate in Syria. The second one is that I think even central bankers, including Fed, they underestimated the impact of structural pressure on production costs and trade costs. So inflation staying higher for longer was not predicted. They thought it's the usual time after 9 months, prices adjust, and after four quarters, you can go back to the baseline. And the reality is that the global economy is still suffering from the consequences of three successive disruptions. One, the COVID pandemic that has still the tail end of it. On hot on the heel of that, you had the Russian invasion of Ukraine that pushed up the cost of a lot of productions and disruption to the global logistics. And then over the past 6 months, you have compounded logistical global trade in the Red Sea. And all of these means that the cost push and inefficiencies have just kept the prices or costs higher for longer, which means central bankers have to keep interest rates for higher for longer.
What's been amazing, though, is to watch how the absolute fear of a U.S. recession has evaporated. And now what worries me more than that is the fact that nobody sees any risk at all. Look at the U.S. economy, looking at the way the U.S. stock market is running, looking at the way the U.S. dollar is performing. It is as if fear has evaporated from certainly from that part of the world.
Absolutely. And then, of course, the other side of it, the other side of the world, China, ran into growth problems and unemployment problems and its own type and variety of cost push increases, trying to cut interest rates to boost economic growth. Then inflation is picking up. So the other side is that the second largest economy in the globe is running into sort of more normal economic cycles, not growing all the time at 6 and 7%. At the same time, U.S. has become a safe haven, an economy that is investing in its infrastructure, investing in its manufacturing, and also investing in its
security industry. And all of that has kept the American economy better, in a better shape than everybody expected.
And it's interesting, Andrew Bailey, who's governor of the Bank of England, is speaking somewhere, probably in London tonight, to talk about how a fragmented world economy is more vulnerable to shocks. And we are seeing big dislocations happening. Geopolitics, of course, the politics of colonization happening, whether China ever does try to take over Taiwan, Russia's attempt to take over of Ukraine, and of course the invasion by Israel of Gaza are all sort of part of a bigger story. But here we've got this really fragmented world, and we're behaving as if there aren't any shocks in the system because we can't see the shocks. But fundamentally, I think Andrew Bailey is right in terms of his assessment here. If you don't have cooperation and collaboration across borders, you do run the risk of short, sharp shocks coming through the system.
Absolutely. I mean, we used to have sort of two blocks in the global economy, and that was bad enough from generating each of them its own shockwaves. Now we have a multipolar, so to speak, global economy fragmented across different fault lines, and each of them injects different types of geopolitical risk. Russia, Europeans, Middle East, China, United States, and increasingly these fault lines are having successive shockwaves that increases geopolitical risk at different levels and in different forms. Some of them affect our energy prices. Some of them affect the logistical cost push. And very importantly, when you have an environment or a period of intensified geopolitical risk, in the name of security, nations have to slow down economic activity. Port inspections take longer. Ship inspections take longer, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All of it, at the end of the day, in economic terms, pushes up the cost of production. We're using productive assets, productive resources to slow the economy down, to slow trade down, to slow transactions, to slow flow of funds, all of that. So essentially, we're investing in creating inefficiency, and that ultimately slows the growth, the global economy, and keeps inflationary impetus or influences into the global economic system. And that means when inflation stays higher, central bankers have no choice but to sit on their hand, watch it for another month or two or quarter before they cut the rates. And even when they want to cut the rates, they're going to be very, very moderate. They're not going to be predictable and so-called hawkish about it.
And then, of course, we haven't even spoken about the vagaries of politics and, you know, voters who are inclined to go for populist or more populist politicians in times of great difficulty. Anybody who tells them a lie that they feel they can believe or at least trust, or at least it's different from somebody else's lies, they may go with. And so we face some fairly, you know, big changes on that particular front as well.
Absolutely. We have a very toxic blend of populism and nationalism. America first, China first, South Africa first, anti-xenophobic, us first and others just stand the queue. All of that also feeds into the populism that then wants to use resources for not necessarily the most productive way, but it does also mean that it prevents or blocks integration, which is conducive to efficiency and higher growth and lower prices. Now, every time that economies, whether they are big or small, they prevent integration, they slow down efficiency, and the flip side of it is that they increase inefficiency, higher cost, and more structural inflationary impetus into their own society. So I think we have those two currents at the same time happening, and then they compound the security problem that we have at the regional or global level.
Dr. Rajabedian reading the signals for us this evening, the Chief Executive at Pan African Investments and Research Services. Raj, thank you very, very much. The New Yorker, which publishes a cartoon every day, and subscribe on social media to their feed. And you can tell that it's a New Yorker because the little girl in her big bed, clearly in some big New York apartment with a unicorn picture above her bed. Dad is sitting on her bed in a tie reading his favorite book. And he's reading the book. It says, first Goldilocks said interest rates were too high. Then Goldilocks said they were too low. Then, in agreement with the Federal Reserve Board, she finally said they were just right. That's the trouble with these things. They are so fiendishly unpredictable, and the consequences we feel each and every single day.
The Money Show.
The Africa Business Report.
The Africa Business Report is brought to you by SAA, connecting Africa one flight at a time, now also flying to Perth, Australia. Ronak Kapoldis is with us, Director at Africa Analyst at Signal Risk, and Iraj Abedian was chatting, touching on the issues within the Middle East and the escalation of tensions in the Middle East over the weekend, and the fact that we've got this conflict which could very, very easily spark a much wider conflagration. One wonders, however, what impact the tensions that we see playing out on our TV screens every day and those people in those regions feel in their everyday lives, how they could affect the African continent. What should we be watching from an African perspective in terms of these Middle East tensions? Nobody better to answer that than Ronak Kapoldis, Director and Africa Analyst at Signal Risk. I want to know what you're watching so that I know what to watch, Ronak.
It's a very tense situation, Bruce, and I think like everyone else, I'm just watching to see what the reaction is. There are really two scenarios on the table, de-escalation and escalation. You know, looking at the first scenario of de-escalation, we know that this was a choreographed attack designed for maximum symbolism and minimal damage. As far as Tehran is concerned, they consider the matter concluded, but it was unprecedented. It was the first direct attack on Israeli soil, and the Cold War has now gotten hot. So the question is if and when Israel responds. And I think here the role of Washington and Joe Biden is going to be quite important. Just in terms of the ability to kind of walk the situation back. Biden has said that they're not going to support a retaliation. And with an election coming in the U.S. in November, with Russia advancing in the Ukraine, with China making a play in the South China Sea, you know, this is something that the U.S. is not going to want. And so if we can dial it back, we get this status quo, tenuous geopolitical situation. But the risk scenario, of course, is that Netanyahu uses this as an opportunity to attack militarily, to boost domestic popularity and nationalism. And that attack then draws in proxies and regional and global powers. And that's been the long-standing fear around the situation. And that's when we really need to watch the contagion. So markets, analysts, policymakers are all waiting with bated breath to see if a reaction will be forthcoming.
Yeah, it's concerning, isn't it? I mean, Africa's financial markets aren't particularly developed. South Africa's got the most developed financial market on the continent. Is it something from a financial markets perspective that as a broad African community we should be worrying about? Certainly maybe from a bonds perspective, a borrowing capacity perspective, I'd certainly see some concern.
Yeah, definitely. And what happens globally has significant implications. And we know that markets don't like uncertainty. So I think we'll see a flight to safety in a risk scenario. In that instance, the US dollar strengthens, which, as you said, is a negative for emerging markets. It drives up bond yields and the cost of financing. Currencies weaken. And with last week's stickier than expected inflation numbers in the US, we should probably then also expect the normalization path for interest rates in the U.S. to be delayed. So that will be a blow again to African sovereigns who waited the better part of 2 years to re-engage in international capital markets. We know that since 2020, we've seen defaults in Ghana, in Zambia, and in Ethiopia. So this is a blow for prospective issuers, and it compresses potentially the fiscal space, which is already cramped even further. And then when you overlay elections in various countries and a political risk premium, this is a situation that that African sovereigns will really want to avoid.
It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, usually when you've got the US economy growing gangbusters like it is and China going along at 5.3%, which is better than expected, you start seeing some sort of interest and demand for commodities. But we're not seeing, other than, you know, some gold demand as a hedge against the risk and uncertainty right now, we're not seeing massive commodity demand, which is something we would have hoped to see, because that's fundamentally shifted as well, it would seem.
Yeah, I think we, you know, everybody's kind of waiting and watching, but I think in the risk scenario, things change quite dramatically. I think, you know, gold as a safe haven asset will continue along its current path. I think, you know, the oil price, which we haven't seen really any movement on, will change if there are supply chain disruptions. So that would be good for African gold and oil producers and their export earnings. But then similarly, if there's a closure of the Strait of Hormuz, which kind of 17% of global oil production flows through, that could really complicate issues for global energy prices. And I think this energy geopolitics is something we need to watch quite closely, especially on the back of what we've seen in the Black Sea with the Ukraine war, with the Red Sea crisis ongoing. So if we see a sustained blockade or closure in another strategic choke point, I think, you know, that's really going to drive up the cost of things, send fear into the market and trigger potentially some significant shortfalls in commodities, which will drive up demand and consequently prices. So, and, you know, as we know, war tends to be quite energy intensive and mineral intensive. So this is something that we need to, I think, keep an eye on. It's calm at the moment, but may not be for very long.
Yeah, geopolitics is frightening. It's massively disruptive, and it's very, very unsettling. And particularly as we look at the Africa's demographics altering and changing, and we see massive growth in population being forecast over the next 30 years, we really need some stability in this global environment, of course, to create the opportunities that Africans need into the future, surely.
Yeah, but unfortunately, it doesn't look like we're getting any closer. This is yet another geopolitical fault line. I mean, if you look at the divisions in global governance, China and the U.S. don't see eye to eye on the U.N. Security Council. Russia and China are closely aligned to Iran, so that compromises the G7. Within BRICS itself, you've now got Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and the UAE, which have recently joined, but then they've got historical ties with Israel, so you don't know which way they're really aligned. And from the perspective of African countries in the global south, they're going to be watching quite closely to see how the West navigates the situation with Israel. But equally, in Western capitals who view the BRICS countries with suspicion, having two countries within the grouping at the heart of global instability doesn't really offset the distrust that they have. And you know, here there's a potential opportunity for the likes of India, Brazil, South Africa, which straddle across the G20, now G21 and BRICS, to kind of try and pacify the situation. But, you know, this political situation and the geopolitics, which is so fluid, is creating real dilemmas for countries around how they balance their interests, their financial interests, their political interests, their international alliances. And the risk, of course, for African countries is that they get drawn into these proxy battles, which then have domino effects on investments, yeah, on security, and the trade relationships.
What do African states do? I mean, I think we've chatted before about how Kenya seems to be boxing smarter than everybody else. Do we look to Kenya, we say, be more like Kenya, or do we start taking sides?
So the calculus is really tricky. And I mean, if you try to draw conclusions from other conflicts like Ukraine and Gaza, they're not very useful, because on the one hand, where you chose strategic neutrality, that kind of really annoyed allies. And then when countries took a more moralistic position, that annoyed allies as well. So there's really not much that Africa can do in the short term, apart from try and protect itself from the contagion and ride the storm. As we've mentioned, the fiscal buffers and the monetary policy buffers are extremely limited. But I think over the longer term, you know, it really is another wake-up call to build self-sufficiency and to build resilience, to focus on things like regional trade integration, boosting domestic capital markets, and playing the economic diplomacy game, which you referenced, strategically to attract long-term investment, which is ultimately critical for the continent's development.
Ronak, thank you. Ronak is Director and Africa Analyst at Signal Risk, joining us this evening here on The Money Show. I'm Bruce Whitfield. This is The Money Show. In a moment, Eyewitness News with Mikey Malapo. We'll also stand by and gird our loins for a discussion with Warren Ingram. He is a director at Galileo Capital and a certified financial planner and a long contributor to The Money Show, for which we're incredibly grateful. On your next show, we've got Mike Brown, the outgoing chief executive at Nedbank. He's steered that company for the last 15 years, including the pandemic, the global financial crisis, all sorts of whipsaws and ups and downs, and in his spare time, he's helped to try and save the country from implosion. He'll be our shapeshifter. Also, we're going to be talking about Wendy Nola, who is our consumer ninja, advocating for your consumer rights, and Graham Codrington, the future of work specialist and author with Business Unusual. Next time on A Packed Money Show.
702.
Bruce is on The Money Show.
Warren Ingram this evening going to be taking on the thorny topic, one that makes many of you quite cross, and that is the topic that people rage about when I say, you know what, you need to save more money. And they go, what money? And I say, but just put money aside. Pay yourself first, all of the phraseology that you get from the personal finance books. Before you spend a penny, before you pay a bill, take 20% out of your pay packet and put it aside, and that is for your retirement one day. And people get so cross with that kind of talk because for many people, there isn't 20% left in the pay packet. There isn't 20% up front because the money is spent usually before it is earned. People live in debt.
The Money Show.
Personal finance with Warren Ingram.
People are losing their jobs.
Over the years, I've had people rage at me
often in which to be an optimistic saving. And some people get furious because
Warren's going to tell us how
they frankly don't have any money to do so.
To some sort of financial stability
savings in the next half hour.
In a life that is expensive.
And I would just use
that. How do you prioritize savings when you run out of money before you run out of month?
And this is a challenge I put you to. Warren Ingram, co-founder at Galileo Capital, personal financial advisor, a certified financial planner. Very few people can even afford to live a comfortable life when they've got an income, Warren, and they can barely, you know, make it through the month anyway. And we keep saying, you know what, you've got to save for your retirement. You've got to have short-term goals. You've got to have medium-term goals. You've got to put money aside to buy a car so that you don't have to buy it on terms. You've got to, you know, if you want to have a meaningful time with your families, you've got to budget for holidays. You've got to make sure you've got a deposit on your home, and don't forget the insurances, and don't forget this and that. And before you know it, you've either got a blood nose or somebody's walked away in a huff and doesn't want to talk to you anymore. So how do we do this? How do we begin to resurrect our chances of financial freedom?
I think you need to be strategic, Bruce, when you look at this. And it's a little bit like when you arrive at the biggest buffet table you've ever seen. What you need to know is your stomach can't accommodate all the food on the table. And if you just start on the left and work your way to the right, you might miss out on some really juicy stuff that you would really like. And I feel it's the same when it comes to your savings. You certainly won't start out with enough money to be able to reach every single goal. And so you've got to be a little bit strategic based on your age, your stage of life, and also your personal priorities. So to me, if you're already just kicking off your career, you've got to go. It sounds funny to say you've got to go safety first, because you know, investment theory would say that, you know, the youngest people can take the most risk with their investments. And that's absolutely true. But you've got no backstop. You've got no emergency fund. You've got no safety net when you're starting out. So I think the very first thing you do is build yourself your own safety net, which means start with an emergency fund. And don't worry too much about anything else until you've got that up and running. So people like me will be telling you that you should save, you know, 15 to 30% of your salary, and that's before tax. And you should be, you know, investing for the long term. And all of that is true. However, what you need to do first is take care of yourself, protect yourself, and form your own insurance fund, your own safety net, and that's your emergency fund. And I think that, you know, if you want a number, it's going to be somewhere around half a year's expenses, at the least three times your monthly expenses. So somewhere between three to six times your monthly expenses. Put that in a money market fund and start making sure that you can look after yourself when life happens. And it's amazing, when you don't have an emergency fund, life happens every single month. And the moment you get a decent emergency fund, life leaves you alone for a little while. And that's what you need, is you need a bit of breathing room. And that's the point. Get the emergency fund, look after yourself, and then you can start to focus on the more interesting, fun, and exciting stuff. And, so kick off number one, emergency fund. Number two, if you've got yourself into a bit of a debt hole, and a lot of people will have that problem, then take care of the most expensive, the highest interest debt that you have first. So don't worry too much. Once you've got the emergency fund, if step two is you've got a lot of debt, then don't focus on the investing. Don't just ignore it for now. What you need to look at is your credit card.
Just pause for a second. What I find so interesting is you're saying, you've got this high interest bearing debt, but the first thing you do is to create the emergency fund. I would have thought the first thing you do is to get rid of the debt, but you're putting it the other way around. And I'm curious as to why you would create the emergency fund in an environment where you're paying for high cost debt as well at the same time. That's compounding the difficulty, isn't it?
It might be, but it's the safety net you absolutely need when things really go wrong. If you focus on debt only and you've got no other financial backstop, what's going to happen is you're inevitably going to hit a financial emergency and you go deeper into debt. The ability to kind of build up, firstly, the discipline. So this is also a little bit about self-education and forming a new good habit, which is setting aside money that you don't spend, that builds up and starts to compound in your favor, and then focusing on debt as a second step. What it allows you to do is kind of just get to the point where you know you've got some kind of a financial backstop. The next time something goes wrong, you're not having to then add to debt. You go straight to your emergency fund and you settle the financial emergency while you continue paying off the debt. I'm not suggesting that you build up your emergency fund and you entirely ignore your debt either, Bruce. I think it's about making sure that you're paying off the minimum required, but then get that safety net going as fast as you possibly can.
But it's, a lot of people, this is where people get cross. They shout at me, they don't shout at you. They say, but you said. No, I didn't. It was Warren. And they don't believe me. It's a really hard thing to get your mind around, Warren, because life is expensive, has become more expensive, and salaries haven't kept up with inflation. And people's lives are tenuous. It's a really tough thing to do. So where does your mind need to be before you even begin this process? I think you've just done the book on psychology and money and getting your mind right. And I know you're not the psychologist. We're going to talk to your psychologist friend about the book in a short while. But it's just that sense of helplessness in the face of so many obligations to get ourselves onto a firm financial footing, which puts many people off before they even begin because it feels impossible.
I think a lot of big goals and a lot of important things in life feel that way before you start. And it's not that, we kind of discount how difficult life is at the moment, and especially around money. What we're saying, and I'm putting words in your mouth here, Bruce, because I think you'd feel the same, is you simply don't have the choice to give up. You simply cannot use that as one of your options, just to throw your hands up and kind of let your money troubles overwhelm you and take you down to the point where you can't recover. If you want to exercise control of your life, if you want to be in a position where you are the master of your own destiny, not the master of your own disaster, then it starts with one small little attitude change, which is all of this stuff is within your control if you take a few small steps at a time. And one of them, the most important, is understanding that, you know, these money difficulties are always going to be there. You're always going to be faced with scarcity where you're going to have to prioritize. And when you're in that position, you need to find a reason to take these actions. You need to find some kind of core calling that moves you forward. It you know, and for some people that might be family. It might be that, you know, they're about to have a baby, and they don't want to bring a baby into the world when they're in a family that's, you know, faced with overwhelming financial difficulty. It might be that you kind of want to launch your own charity one day. Whatever the thing is that's really important to you, you need to find that and focus on that first. That needs to be the thing that when you wake up in the morning and you get up to go to work and you hate your job and you know that you kind of struggle financially, this is the thing that kind of drives you to make these not big decisions. They're small decisions. And it'll be, for example, I'm trading off that third coffee of the day, and I'm gonna rather put that into a bit of extra debt payment, and if you do that every single day, guess what starts to happen? Or I'm just not gonna go out, you know, and kind of spend my money at restaurants and bars and whatever it is. I'm gonna have friends around, and we're gonna share a meal cost together, and we're all gonna bring something. Or I'm not gonna do takeaways. I'm going to kind of cook at home and do bulk meals. There are decisions you can make, small actions you can take. Nothing earth shattering. Yes. If it was rocket science, I wouldn't be talking about it every week. It would be someone far more intelligent than me. All of this stuff is simple to understand, not easy to do, but there are decisions you have to take. Your choices. Don't listen to this and say yes, but you know, life is hard. Of course, it's hard. That's why only 5 out of 100 salary earners retire comfortably. But they're not geniuses. They're not big salary earners. They choose differently from the rest of us, and they make simple choices every single day because something drives them to make the better choice. And that's what we're talking about.
It's, yeah, the mindset that you go into this with, and people go into, and a lot of the, particularly the Americans, talk about the sacrifices you need to make. And I'm not too sure that the language of sacrifice, although it is a sacrifice, I'm not too sure how we talk to ourselves about this, how we think about this is as important as how we tackle it and the actions that we take. If we are go into this thinking it's all about sacrifice and taking away, I don't think we have a sustainable means of putting money away for the longer term, because we keep feeling as if we're missing out. And if we keep looking at the benefit of what we're doing and the advantage of what we're doing and keep a very close watch on the progress that we make, I think it becomes a lot easier to make those changes. I would nearly say sacrifices. Make those changes that they no longer feel like a drudge. It's not that you haven't been to a restaurant this month. It's like you've had your mates around at your house twice and you've been to their houses 6 times. It's been awesome, sort of thing.
Absolutely. And there is no sacrifice when you're working towards something that's really meaningful to you. You know, if it's totally meaningful, if it gives you fulfillment to have that third or fourth coffee, and it gives you no fulfillment to drive a fancy car, then that's the decision you're making. Those are really constructive, really positive choices that you can make. I know a lot of people are going to be faced with much tougher choices than the one I'm describing now. But the thing here is, you can't be defeatist when you start. You have to look at this and say, I'm on a one page kind of plan. I'm going to look at what's really important to me, and if it's, you know, maybe it's travel, maybe it's holiday that really motivates you, and it doesn't have to be anything fancy. It could be something really simple. And if that's what's really important to you, then give yourself the goal of saying, you know, if I can knock my debt down by 100 rand a month extra, I can take another 100 rand and put that towards a holiday. You know, it can be really basic, really simple, and nothing else. You don't have to focus on anything else. Just do that for a period of time. And every month, look at that goal and see how it's growing month after month. And, you know, it kind of share it with your friends that, you know, not the details of how much debt you've got and how big your holiday budget's going to be, but just that you're setting a new goal. And if you're surrounding yourself with friends who are, you know, deeply depressed and telling you that everything's impossible, you need to find some other friends as well. You know, surround yourself with people that have an attitude that's different to that, you know, that are in a position of building their lives. You read some books, listen to the show, listen to the people that kind of make a difference. Their attitude is the thing that distinguishes them from everybody else. You know, pessimists didn't build the world. You know, they're not the ones that launch rockets, you know, and if that's going to be your attitude to money is, gee, everything's about what I can't do, then, you know, enjoy life on the ground while you know, the rest of the optimists actually make a plan and get themselves going.
Pete Mouton, chief executive of PSG at one of their big conferences at Sun City the one year, negative people never build anything. And it is the simplest, most wonderful expression of why optimists rule the world and pessimists, I mean, you know, you need pessimists in the world, they balance things out. What was the line I heard the other day? The optimist builds the aeroplane, the pessimist builds the parachute. Both are necessary. But yes, if you have a more pessimistic mindset, you are going to struggle to make the changes that are necessary. But it's that goal setting and it's focusing on the goals and the outcomes of those goals. So you want long-term goals, you want medium-term goals, I'm sure, but you also need some of those short-term goals, Warren, so that you can see the actions you're taking being fulfilled almost immediately, and you're not waiting till December to treat yourself to the holiday, putting all your money into a holiday fund so you can have the best holiday ever. But by the time you get to November, you've actually been hospitalized for stress and exhaustion, and you miss your flight anyway. And nobody needs that in their lives.
You're absolutely right, Bruce. And I think it's about finding things that give you meaning and fulfillment, you know, things that you can do with your money. And you know, very often it's the very opposite of material things. It's about experiences. And for some people, it might be, you know, kind of buying an extra bag of dog food for the SPCA every month and kind of going there and delivering it and seeing the impact. And for others, it might be helping firefighters that kind of, you know, slog their way through the whole of summer. Yeah. It could be anything. It could be buying some books for kids at school. If it gives you fulfillment and you see your money at work, you know, then that might be a goal. If it's giving your child, you know, an extra opportunity that they might not have had, without the money, then that might be what works for you. But I think it's about making sure that what's meaningful and important to you and fulfilling as a human being, that you make sure your money is working towards that. And you're right, it's not about, you know, sitting down at the age of 25 and setting aside all of this money to your 60-year-old self. That's not going to help anybody. The likelihood of getting there is very small. So it needs to be, you know, incremental goals, and at the same time, you know, setting aside a bit of money for your future self as well. It doesn't matter if it's just 50 rand a month for your 60-year-old self. Do it anyway. But in the short term, give yourself other goals that are extremely fulfilling. And all of these are really positive, constructive choices if you look at them the right way. And for some people, most amazing thing is, you know, I spoke to a young couple and they're entirely motivated by their wedding. And their wedding is going to be 5 years away, but that's what they're focusing on. And that's kind of the most important thing to them, is they want to have an incredible wedding and
they don't want to start life saddled with debt, but have you talked to them about eloping? And just like, you have that mindset of saving for a wedding, but don't spend it on the wedding. Put it into something useful. One day. Oh, my goodness me. The amount of money people spend on weddings. Anyway, let's not go down that particular avenue because I'll get myself into trouble. But yes, making sure that you've got that emergency fund. Paying off those very big debts. Then getting some financial goals in place and getting a sense of fulfillment. And then only, your phase four, Warren. And this is maybe, you know, if you've done this over a year, this is in the fourth quarter of the year. Start to really heavily think about retirement and taking anything that is, you know, that you can afford, and ensure that you are placing that into long-term savings.
Absolutely. I think if we just kind of quick recap on phase one is, you know, the safety net, and then phase two is you know, getting rid of that high interest debt. Phase three is the, you know, the goals, the shorter term goals that give you fulfillment. Phase four might be multi-years away, where you start to then allocate you know, your salary increases, for example, you know, to your long-term retirement goals, and building up, you know, that financial freedom number. So it's just a case of saying, if you can't do it this year, that's fine. You know, if you get a raise next year, then take that raise and set that money aside for the retirement money. And that's the long-term high growth assets that you want to build, and let those compound on themselves. Don't worry about them too much. You know, keep focusing on the fulfillment goals, and making sure that you don't get yourself into new debt. And over time, you know, just kind of revisiting these phase 1 to 4 again and again and again, year after year, watch how these big impossible goals suddenly become more and more approachable, more and more easy to achieve. And you'll have done nothing remarkable from an intellect point of view. This is not, as I said, it's not rocket science. It's just about building little habits, changing the attitude, and then getting up and doing it again tomorrow. And that's the key in this whole thing, is be consistent and you know, and stay focused on what's important to you.
I love questions like Sean's question. Thank you, Warren, for all of that. But I love questions like Sean's question at a time where we've seen the gold price rally about 20% this year, and it's sitting at record levels, and it's wonderful to see gold shining again. And Sean is worried about the chaos in the world. He sees that gold is doing well. Is it a good idea to put some money into gold? And if so, how much money should I allocate to gold? Lots of money 6 months ago. How much now?
I don't know many very wealthy people that have made their fortunes from gold. I know lots of people that are really clever about investing in gold after the gold price has gone up, but not so much before then. So that's the controversial statement. And if I look at how the really wealthy, you know, intergenerational families have been allocated money to commodities like gold, It usually limits itself to somewhere around 5%, maybe at an absolute maximum 10%. And in their lives, it's the ultimate insurance policy. They certainly don't view it as a major investment that's going to generate them, you know, generations of wealth into the future. It's the money that they've got in store just in case, you know, those doomsday preppers are right and the whole financial system implodes one day. But if you're not in that position and you're still accumulating capital and this is an asset allocation decision, my primary answer is, you know, unless you've really got a lot of money, kind of ignore gold and don't worry about the broken clocks, you know, that are right twice a day where they, you know, they're going to be right about gold every 5 or 8 years or whatever it is, and they're all going to tell you, "I told you so," and then they'll be wrong for another 4 years until the next time gold is strong again. But in the meantime, gold does nothing when you hold it. It pays you no interest, no rent, no dividends. It only goes up because someone else is more fearful than you and decides that they'll pay you a higher price than you paid for your gold. And for me, that's kind of a dead asset. And I don't really see the value of holding a lot of gold when you're trying to accumulate capital. If you're sitting on a fortune and your aim is to protect your money and to protect it against as many risks as you can't think about or can't foresee, then sure, buy some gold as a ultimate defense or an ultimate insurance policy. But for the rest of us mortals that are trying to build our money and make sure it grows faster than inflation, I wouldn't allocate a heck of a lot of money to gold. And I'll smile and kind of nod when the gold, bulls tell me how amazingly they're doing because, you know, they're doing it in their, you know, from a position of "I told you so." Once the, you know, the perfect hindsight has come and gone, they really are right, you know, every day of the week and every month of the year.
That is a strong and controversial statement, Warren, particularly as gold looks as attractive as it is. But that is the reality, Sean, that you need to hear, I'm afraid. And it does, yeah, it does depend. And I suppose if you've got $1 billion in assets, you want $100 million spare, and you put that into gold. That means your family, you know, you can rebuild family wealth in the next upcycle if all hell does break loose. But for the rest of us, gold as an asset, nice to have, nice to hold. But sometimes it's better sold. That's the best rhyme I could come up with. That's it for The Money Show for this evening. Thank you, Warren Ingram, Certified Financial Planner, Director at Galileo Capital, for joining us this evening here on the Tuesday evening edition of The Money Show.
Time. The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield was brought to you by APSA Corporate and Investment Banking, bringing you award-winning trade and working capital funding solutions to unlock the full potential of your business story. APSA is a registered FSP.